We are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. Just covering down on some major ground across the northern half of the most beautiful state in the nation. This one right here. Alabama, y'all. Alabama. And I'm talking about this show. We go down like way down south of Birmingham and up north of Huntsville and Tuscaloosa, back to Gadsden, parts of Georgia, Tennessee, Mississippi, all thrown in just for good measure. Hey, I'm going to shift gears completely. Let's stop talking politics for a minute. Let's set that aside and focus on something that is even, you know, deeper and more meaningful, right? Duty, honor, country. Now, listen, there's some speeches that I love. I'm inspired by words. Obviously, I kind of make a living using words, but I'm inspired by meaningful words. I've got a notebook, a little notepad at home that when I find a meaningful quote, I write it down. And it's filled up with everything from key verses of scripture to pastors' sermons to, you know, political speeches to just, you know, athletes saying something, or it's just quotes and things that are said mean something. And I find great import in the ability to take words and to string them together in such a way that it can move people, move them to action, move them to emotion, move them to confidence, move them to victory. Words can mean something. Some of my favorite speeches, and I'll just name a few. If you ever get a chance to read them and you haven't yet, I highly recommend Teddy Roosevelt's Man in the Arena speech. Awesome. I've actually got a copy of that, believe it or not, taped on the inside cover of my favorite Bible. So Teddy Roosevelt, Man in the Arena. And then there's Ronald Reagan's Rendezvous with Destiny speech. Absolutely brilliant speech. Just the words just flow, and it just makes you proud to be an American. Rendezvous with Destiny, Ronald Reagan. There are any number of other speeches along the way that I find. I'm inspired by Winston Churchill. Telling the people that at all cost victory. And so right words at the right time can have amazing meaning. And one of those great speeches is a speech that was delivered at West Point by Douglas MacArthur. General Douglas MacArthur, he spoke at West Point. He was a West Pointer himself. And the speech is called Duty, Honor, and Country. And a part of it is now actually engraved on one of the walls there at West Point. Duty, honor, country. I mean, what does it even, think about what it means. It means that there is something worth serving. You have a duty to do it. It means honor, that there's like integrity. There's actually a sense of special pride in going forward and doing it. And country, that there's a gathering of people that is bigger than yourself, that you are a part of, and you have a duty and an honor and a country. And so I found a couple of stories. I was kind of grabbed by the fact that we lost a veteran in the last couple of days who we've only learned in recent days had a significant record. And then I saw that a Medal of Honor was recently awarded, and I'm thinking, how did I not see this when it happened? And then I saw that the remains of a World War II veteran were just recently recovered, like this week, from a battlefield in Belgium. And I'm thinking, you know, let's talk about this, because, you know, one of those passages of words that is still meaningful to me is the Ranger Creed. If you're not familiar with it, when every Ranger is required to memorize the Ranger Creed. And the stanzas of the Ranger Creed, there's six stanzas of the Ranger Creed, and each one starts with the letters R-A-N-G-E-R. Starts off with, you know, the first R is readily will I display, or recognizing that I volunteer as a Ranger, fully knowing the hazards of my chosen profession, I will always endeavor to uphold the prestige, honor, and high esprit de corps of the Rangers. That's stanzas one. It goes all the way down to the last R, that is readily will I display the intestinal fortitude required to fight on to the Ranger objective. Though I be the lone survivor, Rangers lead the way. In the middle of all that, there's one line that says, never shall I leave a fallen comrade to fall into the hands of the enemy. It's a creed. It's something you're supposed to live by, right? Duty, honor, country. Do you live by any kind of a creed? Do you believe in duty, honor, country? And I don't care whether you believe anybody else does. I'm asking whether you do. Do you believe in duty, honor, and country? Do the words have import to you? I'm not asking whether you believe our current military leadership has it. I could care less what we feel about that right now. I'm talking about why it's worth having. And then I'm talking about things that have happened that you look at and go, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like this story. This past September, and I did not even see this when it happened. So President Biden awarded the Medal of Honor to a Vietnam War vet. He was an Army helicopter pilot. He's now 81 years old. He's Captain Larry Taylor. Lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee, right up the road from where I'm sitting right now in the Right to Hide studio. Well, in June of 1968, by the way, same time my dad was there on his first tour. In June 1968, then First Lieutenant Taylor flew his Cobra Attack helicopter to rescue some men who had become surrounded by the enemy. If you're not familiar with the Cobra Attack helicopter, it was in service for a long time, still around. I think the Marine Corps still uses it. But the Cobra is a two-seater, narrow-bodied gunship. All right, it's not a troop carrier. It's literally strictly a gunship. Got a front seater and a back seater, main pilot and the weapons guy. And so the Cobra Attack helicopter he was flying that day got called in on June 18th of 1968. There was a long-range recon patrol that was under enemy fire. They had been compromised on their patrol, four men. They were deep behind enemy lines. They were discovered by the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong. An intense firefight broke out. They were running out of ammunition, and they had radioed for help. It says Taylor and his wingman arrived within minutes at the site, which is well north of just northeast now, what is called Ho Chi Minh City. He asked the team to send up flares to mark their location in the dark, and he began lighting up the enemy with mini guns and rockets, making low-level attack runs, braving intense ground fire. Both helicopters, after about a half an hour, were actually nearly out of ammunition. The enemy, though, was continuing to advance, and Taylor had surveyed the team's intended escape route to a point near a river, and he concluded they were never going to make it. So he directed his wingman to start lighting up the left side of the field of battle while he lit up the right side of the field of battle with what few rounds they had left in their miniguns. And then he used his landing lights, the bright lights they used to land. Then he used his landing lights to distract the enemy and try to draw their attention while giving the team time to move to a new extraction point that he had radioed to them. And then he flew his non-troop carrying two-seater Cobra Attack helicopter and landed and just told them to get on. This had never been done before. They had never even experimented with the idea of flying troops on the outside of a Cobra. And he said, I just flew up and landed right behind them on the ground. They turned around. They jumped on the aircraft. A couple of them were sitting on the skids. One was sitting on the rocket pods. I don't know where the other one was. And they beat on the side of the ship and they yelled at me to haul. And we did. Well, he left Vietnam in 1970, ran a roofing and sheet metal company up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, with his wife, Tony. He had a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, two Distinguished Flying Crosses. But one of the men he had rescued decided that wasn't good enough. And they spent 6 years lobbying Congress and the president's office to get him approved. And in September of this past year, he was awarded the Medal of Honor. That's just the heat right there. How about duty, honor, country on a man who sat quietly on his own story for decades until someone finally told his story for him? Some of y'all may have heard of Carlos Hathcock. If you follow anything related to the Marine Corps or snipers, you know the name Carlos Hathcock. He was known as the deadliest sniper in Marine Corps history until he wasn't, because we find out now that somebody else had a higher count. So in 1991, the world learned about a guy named Benjamin Chuck Mawinney, who had 103 confirmed kills as a sniper in Vietnam. 103. Well, Carlos Hathcock had a record that was pretty well known of 93 kills. And Hathcock is still a legend. But now we find out about Chuck Mawinney, who joined the military because he was a messed up kid and pretty much was told by the court that the only way you're not going to go to jail is to join the military. So he joined the Marine Corps, and he spent the next several years in Vietnam, 1967 through 1969. Joseph T. Ward was a guy who was his spotter, and Ward wrote his book in 1991. The book was called Dear Mom, A Sniper's Vietnam. Mawinney, the guy I'm talking about, didn't even know that his old spotter had written a book. And people began to make a sort of a kind of an uproar about it. People were kind of ticked, like, Carlos Hathcock is the legend. Who's this guy we don't know about, Chuck McWhinney? Who is that? So an author named Peter Sinich, he went and checked the archives, and he started counting. Not only did he find that, yeah, there were 103 confirmed kills, there's 216 more probables. This man was a machine. But he left Vietnam in 1969, went to work for the U.S. Forest Service. Nobody knew he had a Bronze Star with a Valor device attached to it, a Navy Achievement Medal, a Navy Commendation Medal for Valor, and two Purple Hearts. Nobody knew. But now they do. And when he was finally asked about it through his local newspaper, he said, well, we were all there together. If I got to take recognition for it, I guess that's okay, because every time I get to talk to somebody, then I could talk about other vets. It gives me a chance to talk about what a great job they did. And Chuck McWhinney passed away 2 days ago. Just amazing. I mean, these guys are serving. Like, wow. Well, how about the story of Robert Rudd? Robert Rudd was 31 when World War II broke out. But his mother, Emma, was chronically ill, and he was the only one who could take care of her. So he got a draft deferment for a couple of years, and he stayed with her until she passed away. And then in 1942, he enlisted in the Army, and by the fall of 1944, he was a staff sergeant fighting in Europe with the 2nd Infantry Division. His 38th Infantry Regiment attacked a heavy fortified position on January 30th, 1945, and in the heavy fighting, he was killed amid artillery and gunfire that was so intense that his fellow soldiers could not recover his body. So last month, January of this year, 2024, 79 years after he was killed, his remains were finally identified as part of a 6-year project to account for soldiers lost in fighting in Belgium. It's a joint project between civilian historians and researchers in what is known as the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, which I'm going to tell you more about after this next break. But he was lost in 1945. And the idea of never leave a fallen comrade, it doesn't mean on the field of battle. It means for years you do what is necessary to recover their remains and give them the dignified burial that they deserve. And so, yeah, lost in 1945 in a Belgian firefight, brought home for a final burial in Texas. Robert Rudd's family was shocked to find out recently that his remains were identified and that he was finally at home. Duty, honor, and country. I felt like those stories were just worth telling on a Friday afternoon. And when we come back from this break, I'm going to tell you about that extra piece of the U.S. military you may not even know exists that makes sure that the United States stays true to the creed that we will leave no fallen comrade. Let's take a break right now. We'll come right back. I'll tell you that one. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Duty, honor, country. We'll be right back. Back, Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. Just, I mean, making common sense like a superpower up in here. And listen, this segment I'm doing right now, Duty, Honor, Country, I don't think it's melodramatic. I think it's the kind of thing we have to tell these stories. I mean, I think they're not only a part of the fabric of who we are as a people, but they're the kind of thing we need to pass on to the next generation. I mean, these stories need to be told. And it's not just so that we can, you know, go, wow, that's cool, but it's so that we can inspire the next generation to want to be the same. Duty, honor, country. Philip from Huntsville just texted in and said, thank you, Phil, for those stories about American heroes. So much negative news these days makes my soul feel good to hear about the heroes that died for us to give us the life that we live. Thank you, Philip. Appreciate you, man. Raven from Russellville says, Colonel, you just made an old soldier cry. Duty, honor, country. Respectful salute rendered. Thank you, Raven. Appreciate you, man, as always. Appreciate your service. Welcome home. You may have heard in that last story that I did about the remains of Robert Rudd, a World War II veteran who died in battle in Belgium, being brought home after 79 years. And you think, how does that happen? Did a farmer stumble on it? Maybe. But what happens quite often is what happened in that story is an organization called the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency does a search and finds them. I met somebody once who was assigned to the DPAA. They said it was the most rewarding job they had ever had in the military. So if you're not familiar, I want to tell you about this little-known organization that is out there. I'll take about 3 or 4 minutes here to try and outline it for you. But the DPAA, I mean, you got families that are wondering about what happened to their loved ones, right? And this piece I've got from Task and Purpose says, as a free nation, America's duty is never to forget our missing warriors and to promise to never stop looking for them until everyone is found and returned home. And the DPAA is the agency responsible for upholding that promise and performing that sacred duty. It goes on to say, the agency comprises active duty military personnel from all of the service branches, the Department of Defense civilian employees with specialized skill sets. They employ more forensic anthropologists than any other organization in the world, and they work together to build cases on the missing, develop a plan to recover them, and then physically carry out the mission. And as of May of 2023, 81,000 service members missing from conflicts dating back to World War II and 41,000 others are still considered lost at sea because of ship sinking or aircraft crashing. And the DPAA is the one tasked with trying to find them. It was born out of a need to organize efforts and share talents and have some accountability, and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel in 2014 is the one who finally said, let's have an organization, and we did. Their Bain headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. They have two forensic labs, one at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska and one at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam Field in Hawaii. Each lab has a general area of operations in the world they're responsible for. Since it was established, 1,453 service members, civilians embedded with troops or other personnel like CIA officers have been returned home. They have 700 staff members, several outside agencies and private organizations that also assist with their mission. And their mission statement is pretty simple. It's basically to provide the fullest possible accounting of the U.S. military's missing personnel to their families and their nation. Got a budget relatively low in the big scheme of things, $150 million. They have several different types of teams that work to do research and analyzation or analysis and then attempt recovery of the living or the dead. Doesn't matter, they say, if it's at the bottom of the ocean or with a non-allied country on unfriendly ground, we'll go for it. It says, before a case is established, the agency's historians and the analysts, they comb through all the historical records they can find. They have analysts and linguists, and they research even the host nation archives. And then they have the research and investigations team pour through them like with every record available and a case files built. They say no case is the same as any other. You have planes that go down in the mountains. You have people that are missing during a land battle in a forest, or troops who went missing while crossing a river during a battle, ships that sink at sea. And then they have recovery teams. Once the investigative team has determined that there's reasonable grounds to go for it, you have a recovery team, which will include a forensic anthropologist, a team leader, a sergeant, a linguist, a medic, a life support technician, a communications technician, forensic photographers, EOD technicians, because you never know what you're going to find, and mortuary affairs. And once on site, they begin an actual archaeological dig, and they recover the remains or the indicators that lead to the remains. And cases can take years to build, and sometimes they require worldwide travel. But things like what happened just this week with the remains of Robert Rudd, recovered after a battle in Belgium in 1944. It means something. It means something to the family. It means something to the nation. It means duty, honor, country, and never leave a fallen comrade behind. That's who we are as a people, y'all. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. We'll be right back.